And good morning and welcome to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and now we will be talking with Jordan Clayton, who is Utah Snow Survey's data collection officer, about the history of snow water equivalent data from Utah's snowtell sites and what is happening now. Jordan, thank you so much for joining us today on This Green Earth.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to get into some of the history of your snowtells and data collection. So let's start with the very basics first before we get into the history. And let's talk about your job and what being Utah's Snow Survey Data Collection Officer entails.
So our shop oversees all the collection of snowpack data from 130 snowtell sites in Utah's mountains, and we also oversee all the snowtell sites in Nevada and the area around Lake Tahoe in California. So there's about 230 sites in our jurisdiction that this office covers, and what that means is that we have to, of course, maintain all the instruments and the weather stations themselves, quality control the data, which is a critically important part of what we do, and then produce water supply reports, other presentations to inform members of the public and the media what's going on with our snowpack.
And how long have you been a part of Utah's Snow Survey data collection?
So I joined the team in 2012, and I became the supervisor in 2019. It's been interesting to take on a little bit more of the water supply specialist role. Like the conversation we're having right now, I really enjoy getting to sort of share the message, even if the message isn't what people necessarily want to be hearing. It's important to get the facts out.
Absolutely. And what is it that led you on this path, or what is it that you enjoy about this position?
Well, it's a great question. Part of what I enjoy about being in this role is being surrounded by outstanding scientists and hardworking people. And so we in this office share a lot of roles. We're not just a hydrologist doing the QC processes behind our desks. We also get out and do all the technician work in the field. So there's not a lot of siloing that goes on at this job, which I really enjoy. So everybody's sort of part of, there's obviously different specialties within the group, but we all have a chance to get out and learn from each other, which is great.
So when you talk about being a hydrologist, what does being a hydrologist mean?
Well, it can mean a lot of things. In this case, a background in snow science and understanding watershed hydrology, so understanding when we have snow in a place like Utah, that's essentially the source of 95% of the water that's used in the state for agriculture, municipal uses, everything. And understanding how that water is collected in the form of snow and stored in the ground in the form of soil water and groundwater, how it can be routed through the system, and what makes that an efficient process, what sort of management efforts or considerations that we have to think about when we look at the actual number in terms of the volume of water that's entering a given stream flow location, and what's happened upstream and why.
Sure. So let's now get into the history of how snow data is collected. Originally, what tools were used? What did that look like maybe 40 years ago and moving into what we have today? So when this was first being tracked, how was it being tracked?
Yeah, that's a good question. So 40 years ago was pretty similar to today, although there were some differences. And the snowtell era, which is another, again, name for these automated weather stations that we have in Utah's mountains, really began about 1980 or so, depending on exactly where you look in the West. And in Utah, we actually were measuring snow a lot earlier than that. The earliest location where Utah was consistently measuring snow until the present is the Tony Grove Ranger Station Snow Course, which is a manual measurement location that we have continuously measured since 1924. And we actually had a little celebration for its 100th birthday a couple of years ago, which was fun. But, you know, these manual measurement locations were great, and they give us a long-term picture of how much water content has been in the snowpack over time, how deep the snow has been. But the drawback is that those manual measurements were only typically made one or two or maybe three times a winter, which is sort of the realities of access and other constraints that would have been dealt with. But the advantage of the snowtell system is that these are automated weather stations that provide data every hour. And so we get a picture of what the snowpack is like instantaneously and in real time from over 130 sites in the state. And so we're really able to, I think, nicely assess, again, what our water supply picture might look like from all those, again, snowmelt sites. So the picture really changed again around 1980. And the reason why I say it was a little different in the early snowmelt era versus now is that in the early snowmelt era, it was a kind of a mix of places where we were continuing to measure the snowpack manually at these snow courses mixed with snowmelt sites. And today, we have a few locations that we do manual measurements, but by and large, they're almost all automated, which is, I think, a big boon for our state.
So let's talk about snowtells, what they are, how they work. Just give me a descriptor of what they look like, where they're located, and how the data is collected from them.
Yeah, you're going to have to cut me off because I get excited about this.
Keep going. It's very interesting.
Sure. Yes. So the number of instruments at the snowtell site can vary, but the number one thing that we measure at our snowtell sites is the water content of the snowpack. And the way that we do that is that there's a large, about 12-foot diameter bladder on the ground, typically made of hypalon or some other kind of resistant material. And it's filled with about 160 gallons of a biofriendly antifreeze fluid. And the point of that is that you can feel the pressure that the downward snowpack is exerting. And that pressure can be can be converted to a depth of water in the actual snow itself. So all we have to do is essentially monitor the amount of pressure that the snowpack is exerting, and we then know what the inches of water content are in that snowpack at that site, which is the number one thing that is used to then, of course, predict how much water is going to end up in our reservoirs and other things. In addition to that, we also have snow depth sensors at all of our sites. These are downward-looking acoustic sensors that, of course, tell us how deep the snow is. And I should say that our previous generation of those sensors is being replaced with a more robust model that does a better job, like during storms and some other kind of flaws that the earlier ones had. We have a precipitation monitoring at all of our sites, which is an accumulation type of precipitation gauge. So it measures not just snow, but rain, hail, sleet, anything that falls into the top of the can is measured, which is nice because you don't just get a picture of what fell in terms of snow, but you also get a year-round, whole water year total for what your precipitation picture looked like in summer and winter. We also have soil moisture sensors in the ground, which I'm very proud of because we've not only installed them at every one of our sites at 2 inches, 8 inches, and 20 inches down, but we've also spent a lot of time quality controlling the data to make sure that they're robust. And those, again, those produce data every hour on soil moisture and temperature, which has been very useful both from an understanding of how the hydrology works at our sites, and that can be also used in some other clever ways that I could get into. And then, of course, air temperature at our sites is monitored at a certain height above the ground.
How many snowtell sites are there in our state?
Well, we have about 130 in Utah alone, and the way that they work is that they collect data on a data logger that's stored inside an instrument shelter. Those data are then telemetered back to our data collection office here in Salt Lake City via cell, where we have cell, or via GOES or Iridium satellite networks, where we do not have cell coverage.
So you talked about some are being upgraded in different ways. How has technology advancements helped with this, and who is studying the technology for this? Where are you getting these new inputs or information on how to better these snowtells?
Yeah, that's a good question. We actually have a division within the Snow Survey Program that's an R&D, research and development division, and it's led by a really highly qualified technician and hydrologist named Lucas Zukowicz, who does an excellent job evaluating new sensors that we might want to deploy. Sensors have to really work over a huge range of tough atmospheric and environmental conditions through the West, including Alaska and other parts of the West. And so we put them through a lot of testing. We also, of course, want to know that it's a stable vendor and those kinds of things. So there's a lot that goes into whether or not we can incorporate a new sensor. There are new sensors that are being tested right now at kind of expanded or enhanced sites that have some additional sensors like relative humidity or net radiometers or wind characterization. We even have some snow temperature cables that we've strung at a few of our sites, but those aren't typical for our snowtell sites and mostly are still in R&D mode in many cases.
So when you're collecting all this data and deciphering it and putting it all together, how long does it take you to put out a report? I see there's monthly reports coming through, but how often do you actually collect the data and put out the information?
Yeah, so the information is out there 100% of the time, and it's always current. The trick is that we only have a chance to quality control the data every morning. And so what I would recommend is, if you're interested in what the current snowpack conditions are in Utah or your favorite basin or at your favorite snowfall site, to wait maybe until late morning, because typically the data that that our hydrologists are looking at in the morning, they'll make minor corrections here and there to fix data issues. And then the graphs and the products that you can find on our webpage, they're always live. But if you want to ensure that you have the version that's been quality controlled, I would recommend looking late morning or kind of midday at the soonest. And I should also mention, while we have hourly data coming in from all of our sites, we're only able to quality control the midnight, what we call the daily values, just due to sort of capacity of our staff and other things. And so I would recommend, if you're going to look at our data, all of our products do reflect those daily values. But you can also pull the hourly values if you're interested, but just know that those are raw and have not been quality controlled.
And you put together a very robust report, though, each month. And right. It entails a lot of these numbers. And I look through it, and there's a lot of acronyms, and there's a lot of basic terms maybe that people need to know. What would you say are some of the really important terms when you're looking into this information that people should know? I'm thinking SWE and WYTD. These are acronyms that are used for snow water equivalent and water year to date, but what are some of the ones you think that people really need to know to be able to look into this report?
Yeah, you hit the most important one, which was SWE, S-W-E. That's the snow water equivalent. And so when we talk about the SWE, that's the most important thing that, again, we're monitoring at our snowfall sites. That's that liquid content of the snowpack. So if we took a scoop of that snow, how much liquid content would it have? And then, of course, not just a scoop, but that entire site snow. What is the total water content of that snowpack? That's the SWE. And so that's an important acronym. You already mentioned another good one, which is the water year to date. When we talk about the precipitation, we're talking about what's accumulated since October 1st. Another one that I would mention that's, I think, particularly salient for water resources managers and just people that are interested in their water supply, which would be everybody, is what we call a surface water supply index. And this we include in our monthly reports. I appreciate you referencing our reports. And the Surface Water Supply Index does an interesting thing. It looks at how much water is currently available in the reservoirs of a given basin. And then we add on top of that how much water we think we're going to get once all the snow melts in that basin to get a total volume of water that's going to be available in the summer when you add those two sort of quantities together. And that's your surface water supplies. That's how much water you're going to use for all the purposes. And then you can compare that number to previous years and create essentially a probability distribution of, is this year going to be better or worse than most years? And that's what that index reflects. And it sounds like a lot, but in sort of the short version of that is that when we think about a place like the Weber Basin's surface water supply index is projected to be about the 20th percentile this year. And what that means is that about 80% of the years have had more surface water supplies than what we're projecting for that basin. And so this is, I think, a pretty powerful tool for water managers and members of the public that are interested.
When you look across 3 decades of information that has been collected, do you see some common trends? I know we're going to get into this year and what that means and the data behind it. But over the past couple decades, have there been common trends and changes and things that you expect to see? Or has it been volatile for a while? Can you talk me through the history of your collection of data?
Yeah, volatile is a good word. What I've been looking at is an interesting breakdown in the snowtell data. When you just take a quick snapshot of the whole state, and that's an imperfect way to do this. Of course, there's some really more narrow geographic regions that you could approach. But if you just take a snapshot of the whole state And you think about what this peak snowpack was for the state of Utah going back in time. Volatility is increasing. And so what I did was I looked at the period of 1981, which is essentially the first year of continuous snowfall measurements, to 2009, made that a sort of one clump of one bin, if you will, and then 2010 to the present, including 2026 with a projection to where we might land in 2026. And when you compare those two bins of time, 81 to 09 and then 2010 to 26, there's a really big difference in the variability from one year to the next in the most recent 15-year period. It's significant. It's statistically significant, the difference. And the mean has also gone down a little bit, but the bigger difference is the variability. And I think we all know that sort of anecdotally. The whiplash from 2023, which was our record winter, even going back to the early snow course years, to this year, which is not breaking records anymore, but is still in the bottom fourth percentile for the state of Utah for its overall snowpack. Just a shockingly low amount of snow throughout the state. And that's just 3 years apart. And so it's this interannual variability that's become a little bit more of the norm in the last 15 years. It's hard to manage from a water resources perspective. It's hard to manage a resource that's critically important that changes that much from year to year.
Right. So that brings us to getting into our current numbers. And unfortunately, in February, what was reported in that very top line of that report is that we are in record poor conditions. Can you break down the current data for us now?
Yeah. So the state of Utah is no longer in record poor conditions. We obviously received some really much needed snow last week, mm-hmm. and we're getting a little bit more today. But that doesn't really mean that we're in good shape. In fact, we're still in the bottom fifth percentile of all the observations that we've seen. Put differently, that means that 95% of the time we've been better off than we are today from a statewide SWE perspective. When we zoom in on your area close to Park City, the East Canyon Creek drainage is at about 48% of normal for its snowpack. Which doesn't sound that bad. Of course, that's not a great number, but what's a little bit more shocking to realize is that that area is continuing to break records for its poor snowpack. It's only based on a few snowtell sites, but when you look at how the whole basin is doing for East Canyon, it's in record poor territory, and it continues to be even with that recent snow. Headwaters of the Weber are at about 72%. Some interesting sort of more tidbits, if you don't mind me kind of going on a little bit longer on this.
Sure.
The Thames Canyon snowtell site, which is just above Park City, kind of on the edge of the resort there, the number that it mentions is about 71% of normal, which again doesn't really reflect how shockingly low that site is. It's about 4 inches, a little bit actually more than 4 inches below normal when we look at the actual inches of water equivalent at that site. And that's less than half of the normal peak for that site. So it would need to get more than twice the snow that it has right now in order to get to a normal peak at the Thames Canyon snowfall site. Really, the likelihood when we project forward, the likelihood of getting to a normal snowpack season is very low. And for the East Canyon basin, the sub-basin, actually there's about a 50-50 chance of staying in record poor territory through the peak of this year's snowpack. So the snowpack conditions and our projections are not particularly optimistic.
And Utah snowpack provides the vast majority of our state's water supply. So that's where these concerning numbers push into what is going to happen in our future, what's going to happen in the spring, what's going to happen in the summer. What are some of those predictions being made?
Right. So what we do is we take the snowpack and the precipitation, and we, and also the Colorado Basin River Forecast Center, we being the NRCS, two different agencies both produce really important water supply runoff forecasts from the snowpack and precipitation. We have a slightly different way of doing it, which I think is really great, because then water users in the state can compare the numbers and I think make educated guesses about how much water we think is going to arrive. And when I talk about how much water, we're talking about a volume of water that will be runoff from our snowpack from April through July. And when we look at those runoff forecasts, speaking again about the East Canyon subwatershed, we're looking at about 43% of average runoff for a couple different forecast locations in that subbasin. For the headwaters of the Weber, about 56%, and for the headwaters of the Provo, about 62%. And so we can get into sort of more specific site-by-site numbers, but I think the general picture is the important one, which is we're looking at more or less about half of normal runoff for that April through July period, which is, again, going to be pretty limiting.
And what does that translate to as far as the concerns that might arise from that?
Yeah, it's interesting because we're in the water monitoring, snowpack monitoring and runoff prediction business, but there are people that work really hard on how to manage, of course, this precious resource. And and it's also really challenging in a state that has, of course, a very complex water rights system, and where there's going to be, I think, some, I think the reality is this year, you know, I don't have insights on this, but it would be hard to not sort of appreciate that there's going to be some winners and some hard losses for who gets water and for how long this year.
Right, and we have been having obviously very robust conversations about the Great Salt Lake and the loss of water there. It's below normal at about 58% of median. That was reported at the beginning of February. What are some predictions for runoff for the Great Salt Lake that you're seeing now?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we started producing inflow predictions to the lake a couple years ago. We do include those in our suite of runoff predictions now. And they're a little bit more uncertain than our typical forecasts, so I do want to sort of explain that caveat first. But all that aside, there's a range. It's a probabilistic distribution, so we tend to focus on the middle value, but I want to stress that there's a range of possible outcomes. That being said, the most probable number is in the middle of that distribution, and it points to around 290 to 300,000 acre-feet of water coming into the lake. Which is about 40% of average, so well below average runoff into the lake. That's a forecast based on February 1st conditions, so we'll see a little bit of a difference once we get into the March 1 report and those new generation of forecasts. We also produce what are called lake level rise forecasts. And when we look at how much the lake is going to come up from, for example, February 1st until whenever it peaks, and when we did that for the February 1st report, we predicted, again, a wide range, but the middle value was around 0.6 feet, which would put the lake at about, I don't have the number in front of me, but about 6.5 feet below the bottom end of what the DNR calls the optimal range for the lake, which starts at 4,198 feet above sea level. So I think, if I'm remembering right, we're predicting about 4,191.5 or so that the lake will max out this particular year.
So when you look to the future, what are some of the things that would make for a positive outcome, and what are some of the realities we might be facing?
So a positive outcome in my mind is plentiful snowpack and an abundant runoff. It probably should be an opinion shared with most people in Utah. And so to me, you know, obviously abundant snow through the end of March, February through March into April, actually through April. And then if we could see that runoff get generated in sort of a narrow window of time, we don't want that when we're worried about floods, but I'm not particularly concerned about floods this year, given what we're looking at in our mountains right now. That could change, but right now it doesn't look like a major risk. Instead, what we get when we have the runoff narrowed to a shorter length of time is that it tends to be more quickly and efficiently routed to our reservoirs and our other downstream collection points, as opposed to being spread out over a really long period of time, which reduces the overall proportion of that water that makes it into our storage systems. So if we could get abundant snow and cold temperatures and then a sort of snap into warm temperatures, maybe around May 1st, that would be kind of the recipe for getting as much water out of the snow as we could get.
Well, we can hold out hope for that.
Sure.
But we will keep relying on you for the truth. And we thank you so much, Jordan, for breaking all of that down for us. We are speaking with Jordan Clayton, who is the Utah Snow Survey Data Collection Officer for us here in our state. Thank you so much, Jordan, for being a part of This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate your questions.